Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. We have two handouts for you that are in there in the back of the room. One is assignment two, so we have a significant drop in attendance, and I bet that a lot of people are scrambling last minute to get the assignment one sent out. But assignment two is now up and ready for you to get started. It's like assignment one will be due 3 weeks from now, so it will be due October 12th. And then the other handout is the one that I talked about last week that I was unfortunately unable to print out at the time. It's the aperture and F number handout, where we talk about we go over the math that we discussed a little bit, just to give you hopefully a little bit more insight into how the F number relates to the aperture, why it is so confusingly numbered, and how we can use that to calculate some interesting things for a variety of reasons. So, moving on, we've been talking about exposure now for the past lecture and a quarter or so, and we have some more to talk about. So even though last lecture, I really like the last lecture, just because it's sort of, I think, the one lecture that gives you a huge increase in skill. Like, once you start to understand and learn how these three exposure values relate to each other, how you can use them to your advantage, then you'll suddenly start to realize how you can take photos like you want. So in other words, how you can get photos with the background blur, how you can get photos with sort of the motion blur that might be captured, or how you can eliminate either of these two things. Of course, we are limited by our equipment for each of these things. And that's part of what this assignment is for, or rather the first assignment. The first assignment has a goal really to not only get you to start to use and understand these three exposure values, but also to see where the limitations of your own camera, of your own equipment, might be for each of these. So I've gotten some emails from a number of you that were having difficulty getting the background to really blur with some of your cameras. And this is, frankly, just a function of some cameras. And we could generalize and oversimplify and say that the cameras with the smaller sensors tend to have not as good of a capability of producing as much background blur as cameras with larger sensors. This is technically incorrect, but it's an interesting way, and it's an easy way to think of it, at least. So these smaller compact cameras just cannot get the background blur that some of the larger ones can, for a variety of reasons that, of course, we'll talk about later, et cetera, et cetera. So this is part of the goal of these assignments, is to get you to see and understand these things, but also to get you to start to use each of these exposure values. And I know that some of you have been struggling with them and saying, okay, I'm starting to get it, and that's good. I'm really happy to hear that if some of you were struggling with it, maybe now at the end of this assignment you were starting to understand it. That makes me happy, because that's entirely the point of this assignment, is to try to get you to start to use these and try to get you to start to understand. And don't worry about it, you will pick it up. We have three more assignments, including this second one, and you will and the final project, and you will know by the end of the semester how these three relate to each other pretty intimately, I think. And today we'll continue with this idea. We're going to be talking about metering and how the camera is actually able to determine how it can expose, how to actually set each of these three exposure values, and what each of the different metering modes are. And hopefully after today, even though now with this assignment one under your belt, you will hopefully have less of a reliance on these automatic modes, and we've been forcing you to use the manual modes, we'll be talking about some intermediate modes that are sort of not fully automatic, that you might have been using before, but not fully manual, which, let's be honest, is a pain to use all the time, because it takes time for you to be able to set it up properly, get the exposure right. It can be some guess and check, it can be some lucky chances. It really depends how you can do it. But there's ways that we can still use our knowledge of these three exposure values and still have the camera help us out a little bit, and we will be talking about that today. But before, of course, we can get to that, we should just review these three exposure values that we talked about last week. The first being shutter speed, where the shutter speed is defined by the speed of the shutter that opens, exposing light to the sensor or to the film in the back, and then closing. So how fast or how quickly this mechanism happens. And of course, just like all of the other exposure values that we'll be talking about, this operates in terms of stops. So we might have one stop brighter, which means that we have the shutter open for twice as long. So it has half the shutter speed as we would of a shutter speed that is one stop darker, for example. So if we had this photo right here, and we had a shutter speed of one and we'll round down to about 1/1000th of a second. How could we make this one stop darker? Hopefully now this should be easy peasy. How can we make this one stop darker at 1/1000th of a second? 1/2000th of a second. So we have to make it twice as fast. So 1/2000th is faster than 1/1000th, so we will get a darker image as a result. Going the other direction to make it one stop brighter, we would do 1/500th of a second, up from 1/1000th of a second. Now, of course, this at these speeds, you probably aren't going to notice much of a difference in motion blur. But as soon as we start getting to some appreciably slower speeds, like 1/2 second, 1/4 second, 1/8 of a second, so on and so forth, then you will start to notice an appreciable difference in how long your shutter is open. You will visibly hear it opening, and then there's this sort of delay as before it closes. And this is, I mean, of course, normal because the shutter has to be open for that long, but this can also introduce some of the effects that we've been talking about last week, like the motion blur. If you have it open for a significant amount of time, you are very likely to get some motion blur unless you have stabilized not only the camera, but also the subject as well. And so this might or might not be what you want. It all depends, of course, on your subject. Sports in particular, we typically want to have a relatively fast shutter speed so that we can capture the action without having any distracting motion blur. Of course, you can have some artistic freedom and use slower shutter speeds if you want, but it may or may not be the result that you intend. Okay, now when we're talking about all of this, of course, I'm talking about stabilizing the camera, so we talked about using a tripod, and I just want to bring up a couple more things regarding this, and that was to remind you about the mirror lockup option that many cameras, especially SLRs, will have. SLRs, it really applies only to SLRs because SLRs are the only cameras that have mirrors. But in cameras that have mirrors like SLRs, and you need to try to get the camera as stabilized as possible, sometimes the flipping up of the mirror will cause an extra little bit of shake. So you might want to look at your settings to see if you can enable mirror lockup to try to get the camera to be extra still so that you can flip up the mirror initially, have it rest for a little bit and let the vibrations die down, and then take the photo itself. One more thing is the bulb mode. So many cameras have a hard limit of about 30 seconds for a shutter speed. Many compact cameras, many digital SLRs, doesn't matter how fancy they are, typically will not have a shutter speed slower than 30 seconds. So to overcome this, if you want to take a photo that is measured in minutes or more, then you have to use something called the bulb mode. The bulb mode allows you to hold down the shutter button, and as long as you are holding down the shutter button, the shutter will remain open and it will continue collecting photons. It will continue collecting the image that you might want. And several cameras actually have a bulb mode on their metering dial. Some cameras, you have to set it in a different way. It really depends. Again, you have to look at your specific manual to get it to work. But using this mode, it's usually a good idea to then have an extra remote that can lock the shutter open, and to have a timer of some sort that you will be able to then determine, okay, it's been open now for 2 minutes. I know that's how long I want the shutter to be open. Now I can stop this particular action. Now, moving on, the second of the three exposure values was the ISO. So this, we can think of it essentially as increasing the sensitivity of a sensor, though that's an overgeneralization and not exactly true. The benefit of this is that we could then perhaps have a much faster shutter speed if we wanted. So if the room was dark, we might need to have a slightly higher ISO or even a significantly higher ISO to get a shutter speed that would allow us to hold, to be able to get a still and motion blur less photo that we're trying to capture. The downside to increasing the ISO, of course, is that we might then get some splotchiness, some noise, as it's called. And it really depends on the camera, how old the camera is, the size of the sensor, and a variety of other factors that determine how much noise we actually get. Generally, newer, bigger cameras will have much better noise characteristics than older, smaller ones. The range of the ISO, of course, is up to the camera. Many compact cameras will start at about ISO 100, go up to maybe 800. Nowadays, sometimes even 1600. It really depends. Sometimes they are a little over generous with how much ISO you can actually get and still have a usable amount of noise. Sometimes you will take a photo with SLR cameras that has such a high ISO and it just looks horrible just because there's so much noise. So you really have to determine not only the range of the camera, but the range of ISO that's usable to you. Maybe the range that you deem acceptable out of your camera is only a subset. So for example, my own camera goes from about 100 to 6400, but I find 6400 to be really obnoxious. It's really, really noisy, and I'll use it only in dire emergencies. If I absolutely have to take a shot at that high of an ISO, I'll do it, but otherwise I'll try not to. Now, the third and final way that we can limit the amount of light that comes into the camera is to change the aperture, to change the F number of the lens. And you might recall that this is very much like the iris of our eye, how it might close down a little bit so that we let in less light in very bright conditions. When we're outside, for example, our iris is much smaller, it's much narrower versus when we're indoors and it is dark. Very similarly, cameras have the same sort of idea, where there is an actual aperture that will actually close down. It's a physical aperture that will close down and limit the amount of light that comes in. So as a result, there is a maximum aperture that results in the lowest F number possible for a particular lens. Many zoom lenses will start at about maybe F2.8, or high quality zoom lenses will have a maximum aperture of about F2.8. Sometimes they will vary depending on how zoomed in you are. Of course, we'll talk more about that later, so on and so forth. Many prime lenses, one of the advantages of having a prime lens, is a lens that does not have a zoom capability. It's only a fixed focal length. Many prime lenses typically have much better maximum apertures. They can just support a much wider aperture, and they can therefore let in more light that's available to us. Now, we talked, and again, I'll have to defer you back to the aperture and F number handout to figure out a little bit more information about why the F numbers are as crazy as they are. But you might recall that the way that we would remember this is to start with F1 and F1.4 and double each successively. So we might have F2, then F2.8, then F4, then F5.6, so on and so forth. That's how we could remember one stop differentiation between all of the F numbers, so that F2.8, for example, is one stop brighter than F4, and F5.6 is one stop darker than F4. So it's a good way of remembering each of these things. Okay, so with that, we have the three exposure values under our belt. Do we have any questions on this before we move on to metering? Okay, so the camera now understands all of these things. It understands what a stop is, I'm being generous by saying that it understands this, but at least is programmed to know what one-stop difference is and how it can adjust and modify each of these things depending on the particular mood. But how is it able to predefine what all of the available light is? So how does it know, for example, that it should set, say, the Sunny 16 rule or some variance thereof? How does it know? Well, there is a meter built into every camera, whether it be digital camera, a compact camera, or even some of the older film cameras, not the purely manual film cameras, of course, but many film cameras actually did have meters available within them. And what the meter does is it reports to the camera how much light it thinks is in the scene. And essentially what the camera is looking for, rather what the meter is looking for, is a scene that looks like this. Completely gray, about a middle gray, halfway between black and halfway between white. And what it is considering black and white is what it knows is the range of the sensor. So what it knows is absolute darkness for the sensor, and what is absolute brightness for the sensor. It will pick about a middle gray in there, so it looks like something like this, and will try to change each of these three values so that overall we will get an exposure that looks sort of dull and gray. Of course, scenes are much more complex than this, and so there has to be a little bit more intelligence to it, and we will talk about how these different metering modes that might exist that allow a camera to make slightly more intelligent guesses about what light is available in a scene. But essentially, this is what it is. And for many, many cases, you will see a meter, or you will see many cards or little metering cards that are available. People will talk about this idea of 18% gray. They throw around this term, 18% gray, 18% gray, and it's essentially supposed to mean this middle gray. 18% gray is the amount of gray that's printed on a card that's supposed to reflect something halfway between black and all the way to white. And this is a term that's been thrown around for a long, long time in the photographic world, and many people disagree with it. They say that 18% isn't actually an accurate way of describing the amount of reflectance of this. So you'll see a lot of arguments online. It's not actually 18%, it's actually 12%. Who cares? It's frankly sort of a moot point, I think. The idea is important, though, that there is a card or there is something that is reflecting light. It's important to realize that there is a difference between light that is reflected and light that is just illumined, that is just coming from a source. So for example, you are seeing me because light is being reflected off of me. I'm not giving off light. I'm not that radiant, okay? But there are lights in here, and they are giving off light. So you can look at that, and you can see that there's light coming out of these sources. But what's more important, what a camera will capture a scene of is reflected light. And this difference is important, and it actually does does actually make some difference for metering, as we will see. Now, for many SLRs, this metering happens in a mode called through the lens, TTL. You'll sometimes hear this thrown around as well. TTL just means that something is happening through the lens. Whenever you're looking through a viewfinder of an SLR camera, for example, you're actually viewing the scene through the lens, so TTL, because that scene is coming through the lens, it's being bounced around the mirrors inside, and before it is presented to you in the viewfinder. So many times you will see in relation to metering this concept of TTL, and it doesn't really apply to compact cameras, or it could, I suppose, because it can be metered through there, but there are cameras that don't necessarily meter through the lens, and there's some flash units that will do the same. Now, it's one of the things about metering to this sort of middle gray, halfway between black and halfway between white, is that it's not very representative of the scene as a whole. So what if we just looked at the entire scene and just averaged all of the brightness that we saw within it? This may not be a very good way of determining the proper exposure of a scene. Just as an example, let's say that you were taking a photo of me up here on this stage, and I was holding a very bright light. Now, if you took a photo that captured not only me, but also this light, and it did something like this, the camera metered that scene for something like this, just the sort of middle average gray, this may or may not be what you actually intend, because this very bright light is going to outweigh, perhaps, the darkness of me, the darkness of the light that's being reflected off of me. It will just be much less. So you might then get a photo, if you take that photo, that appears to be slightly underexposed, because you might have this very, very bright object in the scene, and averaged with this other area within the photo itself, you might just get a very dark photo. And in fact, I guess rather than me holding up a light, a better example would be me standing right here, right next to the projector. If you took a photo of this scene that contains mostly the projector, and then me over here, I will appear very, very dark. The reason for that is that this projector is very bright, even though we don't think of it actively as humans, because our eyes are very good at adapting to different lighting situations, but cameras are not really. So this bright region of the projector right here would overpower the darkness of the light that's reflected off of me. So this may not be the best way of determining exposures, just by using the entire scene as a whole. So camera manufacturers have come up with a variety of metering modes to try to help us pick the right exposure. So one that's very popular, for example, is this spot metering. What spot metering does is it takes a very tiny fraction of the scene in the very center of the image, and it will use that, and it will say, okay, whatever is in the center, I'm going to consider this 18% gray or 12% gray or however you want to describe it, and it will meter the entire scene for that. So what will happen if you take a picture of me again, and I am right here in the center of your photo, and you are framed in such a way that, you know, the center of the photo is right here. Now I'm wearing a green shirt, and this isn't a very bright green shirt, but it might give you a better idea, especially if you figure out what the exposure should be based on my brightness, and then you recompose the image to include something else. So let's take a look at what this actually does. So what we're looking at here is basically just sort of a two-dimensional image. So you can see the image as a rectangle. It's just sort of made to look a little 3D. And this is telling you the importance of various pixels within the image in terms of exposure. So we can see the very middle portion of this image is the most important region for the camera to determine exposure. So if we have a camera that's set to a fully automatic mode and we're using spot metering, What this means essentially is that if there is something, well, whatever is right in the middle, it's going to consider that as being this middle gray. It's going to try to change those exposure values so that that portion of the image will look like this, this sort of middle gray. Now, obviously, there might be color involved, and so it may not actually look gray, but the idea is the exposure. It's how bright that portion of the image should be. Now, this would be fine if I were wearing a shirt that is deemed acceptable in terms of the 12% or 18% reflectance, if that's how much my shirt was reflecting. But let's say I was wearing a very, very dark shirt, for example, or a very, very bright shirt, and you put the middle of the scene, the middle of the frame, right there on that shirt. So let's go back to this example of me wearing a very, very dark, very black shirt. What would happen is that the camera would try to make that black shirt gray. So in essence, what would the photo as a whole look like? Speak up a little bit, I hear some mumbling. Right, it will be overexposed because the camera will try to compensate for the black that it sees in the center portion of the image, make it too bright. So it might then do a number of things. Might lower the shutter speed, might keep the shutter open for a longer time, might increase the ISO. It really depends on the exposure mode that you're using in that particular case, but it will do something to try to make that black shirt gray. Similarly, if I was wearing a white shirt, it would do the opposite. It would say, okay, the camera has no concept of what white or black is, but it just thinks that whatever it's looking at should be this middle gray, so it will try to make that white shirt middle gray, therefore everything will appear to be underexposed. Now, this spot metering, you might say that, well, this doesn't sound very useful, but this is actually extremely useful of a metering mode, because you, the human, can figure out about what portion of the scene is actually this sort of middle gray. So maybe you could look at this scene and say, okay, well, this part right here that's not actually being projected on appears to be sort of a middle gray. So what you could do is you can point the middle of the camera at the portion of the scene that you believe to be correct in terms of middle gray. You can then tell the camera to figure out the exposure values that it's supposed to use. You can hold on to that, and there is a feature called exposure lock. You can actually cause the camera to meter the entire scene based on, if you're using spot meter, maybe this little portion right here, and it will give you the three exposure values. Then you can tell the camera to remember those three values. Just hold on to this button and it will remember those values. Then you can recompose. So you can actually change where the camera is looking at. So now what you can do is you can take a look at you can have the camera meter this portion right here. This might be a little dark. I'm just using it as an explanation. You can meter on this portion right here, and then you can recompose maybe onto me or onto some other object in the scene, and then take the picture. And that will give you the result that you expect. So spots takes a very small fraction in the middle of the scene, about the middle 3% of the image, to try to figure out what the exposure values should be. It meters based on that middle 3%. Now there's some other ones as well, like spots, or center-weighted rather, and center-weighted looks a bit more like this. And this is a little bit less restrictive than spot, but this makes the assumption that everything you were taking a photo of is in the center of the screen, is in the center of the image. This may not be so useful, for example, if you're trying to take an image where I am on the side of the frame like this, and you're trying to take, you know, something to the right of me that's just captured as part of this image. You can imagine, let's say you were outside and you were trying to take a portrait of somebody that was on the very edge of the frame, and behind them was maybe very bright or very dark area because there's the sun or the lack of sun or what have you. Now all of a sudden this difference in lighting will become very, very apparent to you when you take the photo, because it will meter only the center, only the background, which was not that important in the scene to begin with because it was the background. So the camera has no knowledge, when you're using one of these modes, what is the subject of the scene, what the camera should actually be metering for. So these modes, while useful, are potentially of only limited use because they don't actually give the camera a good idea of what the subject of the scene is and how it is able to, and how it should use the exposure values to properly expose the scene as a whole. And while all of these things would definitely properly expose something within the image. It may not be the something that you intend, and that is the problem that this brings up. So these modes, most cameras actually have these modes. Many Canon digital cameras actually have center-weighted mode, and they didn't actually have spot mode. Nowadays, a lot of the newer Canon cameras are coming now with spot, and it's sort of silly because spot mode has been very popular with many photographers for years, and for some reason Canon didn't include them in their cameras. But for whatever reason, they're there now, and that is certainly a good thing. But none of these, like I said, will actually do a good job in telling you what the subject of an image is. So they try to combat this with technology. They have come up with this new, well, it's not new anymore, but there's this metering mode called zone metering. And pretty much every modern camera on the market today uses a form of zone metering. And you will see these cameras, they market it with, they try to market how many zones they have, and they say how important having extra zones are. Frankly, it doesn't matter how many zones you have. I think Nikon likes to say we have 1,000 zones in an image or something like that. It's sort of silly, and it's sort of a marketing thing, and so you really don't have to care too much about it. What's more important is that you actually have this capability to begin with. What it does essentially is it breaks up an image into zones. So in this case, I've broken up the image into a relatively low 9-zone area. So there's three zones of rows, there's three rows, and there's three columns, and each of those together makes 9 different zones. Now, what this allows the camera to do is to take a variety of things into account. So, for example, let's say that you are focusing on a particular portion of the image. Let's say that I have focused on the people here on the right middle zone. Now the camera can say, okay, this person is trying to focus on the right middle zone, so maybe that is the most important aspect of this image, and maybe I should use this zone maybe I should rank this zone as being the most important when I'm trying to meter the scene. So it will look at this zone in the farthest right-hand side and say, okay, this is the most important zone because this contains the subject that the person is trying to take a photo of, and I will therefore meter this to be about this 18% gray. So it can use the autofocus point that you select in this zone metering to try to figure out what would be proper or what would be a proper metering for this. Now, this zone metering is, I'm sure, a bit more complex depending on the manufacturer. Many of the zone meters are different from one manufacturer to the other. Some are able to do perhaps better jobs than others. Many modern cameras do a fine job with zone metering, but really it depends entirely on what on how they've implemented this, but it can take other things into account as well, like the prevalence of color, for example. So here we have a pretty good blend of relatively neutral colors, but if I was taking something that was very heavily green, for example, or very heavily red, it might take this into account, the actual color itself into account when trying to determine the exposure, because not all colors are created equal when we're looking at the brightness of an image, as we will see, of course, later day, et cetera, et cetera. Another thing it might take into account is backlighting. If it considers that the most important zone is this middle zone right here, and it somehow is able to figure out that there are some brighter zones elsewhere, then it might say, okay, maybe these zones are backlit areas. They're out of focus backlit areas, so it will place less of an emphasis on metering for those very brightly lit zones compared to the ones that it has deemed more important. Yes?
So the zones appear on the digital camera, the LCD display. I think I may have inadvertently brought that up. How would you approach this?
I've never seen a digital camera that will actually show you the zones, the metering zones, but usually what it will show you, and I've reused this slide actually, you might recall this when I was talking briefly about composition in the first or second lecture. So I just reused this as an example of zones, and most likely that is the similar sort of thing that your camera's trying to do. Many cameras will actually give you an overlay that looks like this, but rather than red lines, it'll be black to try to help you with the rule of thirds. So you will be able to divide an image evenly into thirds, and you can use that as a tool to help you with composition. Usually you would have to look into your display preferences or display settings to try to turn that off. It really depends on your particular type of camera, but most likely it's a composition tool rather than a zone tool or anything like that.
I have no idea how I got it there, so.
Yeah, it's that's I think fiddling will probably help a little bit in that case, and looking at the manual. Just most likely it's showing you many cameras these days can actually put an overlay like this to help you with that. And there's they have different levels. Some will actually show you more lines, and it can just get kind of ridiculous. Yes?
Because the zoom mirroring, when it's most important, may not be really mid-grade, right?
May not be, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then what makes this one more advantageous than the, you know, center weighted or actually the spot?
So what makes this more advantageous over the other two modes, spot and center weighted, is that it gives you a speed advantage. Because with spot and center weighted, you can still accomplish the same thing. We can still put the center of the image, or we can focus the center of the camera at this place where I've deemed to be the most important and where I think is sort of a good middle gray. Meter that region of the image and then recompose the image. But for a shot like this, you don't really have time to do that. Even if it takes you half a second, you might have missed this shot by then. So using zone metering, it gives you an advantage because all you have to do is you can focus more on the other things, like actually composing it properly, focusing it properly, rather than having to deal with the additional task of metering as well. So this, it's taking an assumption. Because you have focused on something, it is making the assumption that that is the most important aspect of the image. And I think that's a fair assumption in most cases, unless you are focusing on something and then recomposing later, then perhaps it's broken, but that's not the common case necessarily. What's common is for you to focus on something, on the thing that you're actually trying to take a picture of. So even if it's not middle grade, we'll consider this area, and for cameras that have many zones, it will consider the surrounding zones as well when looking at the meter or when metering and trying to figure out the exposure values. So while this may not be a proper middle gray, you know, right there in that exact zone, it can use that zone as a tool to help it figure out what might be good or what might be a middle gray. It may not be necessarily, just because it's zone metering doesn't mean that it will use only that one zone when metering. It will definitely use surrounding zones as well to help it figure out, to help the camera try to figure out what sort of scene it's looking at and how it can modify the metering capabilities, or how it can modify the exposure values of the camera for that particular scene. So zone, I mean, we can really only talk generally about zone metering just because it's implemented differently by different cameras, and it's sort of a mystery, frankly. It's how each of these manufacturers have decided to implement it that is sort of a mystery to us. But we can say that by generalizing like this, that this is most likely they use some of these ideas when looking at zone metering. So zone metering is typically the best way that you will get a well-metered, well-exposed photograph through the camera rather than having you manually do it yourself. And again, if you're doing this manually, this would be quite a pain in the butt to try to get this exposed properly, unless you knew ahead of time what the exposure values would be. So it's important, though, that to realize that the camera is not, it doesn't understand the scene. It doesn't know what it's looking at. I've been anthropomorphizing it this whole time by saying that, you know, it can kind of figure out what all of this is. But no, obviously it can't figure out what this is. It's programmed to try to figure out, there's that word again. It's programmed to react to how a particular scene might look, to try to figure out what these exposure values should be. And so frankly, sometimes, many times, this will fail. Now, one case where this will fail is extreme cases of really white areas or really black areas. So like we had talked about before, it was a very good point that how does the camera know that, or why, or is it a safe assumption to say that the focus point of the camera is actually a middle gray? What if it is something else entirely, like this, where I focused on these people here, where they're wearing relatively dark jackets, and the camera says, okay, well, this should be middle gray, so it will overexpose the scene as a whole. Or what if I have focused on something over here, this very white snow area, then it will try to overexpose, or it will try to underexpose the snow as a whole. So we have to do an additional step, sometimes, called exposure compensation, where the camera has performed the metering. It's told you what it thinks should be the exposure values for this particular scene, and you might know better than the camera. You can say, okay, no, I know that this is a special case for this scene, and I'm going to modify the exposure by a slight amount. And they call, pretty much all manufacturers call this exposure compensation. And what this means is that you get to modify, you get to tell the camera that you want to override its meter. You want to say, okay, I actually think that this should be a stop brighter, or two stops brighter, or two stops darker, really depending on this, on the particular type of scene that you might have. And the particular cases that you might think of as being special cases in this way, that you will be, that you will, red flags, if you will, that you think that you might have to use exposure compensation, are scenes like this, snowy scenes, or scenes where the person is wearing a very dark or very bright jacket, or very dark, very bright clothing, anything that can fool the camera into thinking that it should be middle gray, but it's not. Sunset, sunrises, backlighting, dark light jackets, objects, lots of shadows, this sort of thing, you should sort of fire a red flag in your mind to say that you should look at the photo and determine if it has actually been properly exposed or not, and modify the exposure compensation as necessary. Now, here's an example of where, even though I've used zone metering, it still is not correct. So on the left, for example, was the original photo. This was the photo that that I took, and it's of a snowy scene. And for the most part, this scene is actually pretty bright. There's a lot of snow on the ground. There's some light in the sky as well. And even though there's some dark regions within this photo, the metering didn't get it right, because it assumed that this snow, even though it was focused probably at the part where the railroad tracks turn slightly, the snow, it assumed, was supposed to be a middle gray. And so because snow is supposed to be bright, I know that I'm supposed to turn up the exposure compensation. So what I'm going to tell the camera to do is to increase the exposure compensation, that the scene as a whole should be brighter than what it tells me it should be. So on the left was original, and this was 1/80th of a second at ISO 400 at f2.8. But that, of course, is too dark of a scene. We can see that it is just far too dark, and snow should not be gray like this. Snow should be bright, should be relatively white within the scene without overexposing it so that you lose all of the details. So you have to increase the exposure compensation. So I told the camera that it needs to be about a stop and a third brighter. So 1.3 stops brighter for it to properly get this white detail out of the snow. And so I increased the exposure compensation by 1.3, and what that did was it might have done a variety of things, but as we can see now, it kept the shutter speed the same at 1/80th of a second. It uses now a stop faster ISO, so it's ISO 800 now instead of 400, and it made the it opened the aperture by about a third to f2.5. Yes. So I changed, So this could have happened a number of ways. If we were at a fully automatic mode, the camera might decide, it really depends on how it's programmed, the camera might decide to increase the ISO for you, depending on the other exposure values. But you can also do it yourself. You can increase the ISO by 800. So what happened here was that I told the camera that I wanted it to be 1 1/3 stops brighter. And because of the metering mode that I typically use, what it was going to try to do was to try to change the shutter speed for that. So a stop and a third brighter in terms of shutter speed would mean that it would be about 1/30th of a second rather than 1/80th. And that is a little bit slow, I thought, for this particular scene, especially since it was darker, and 1/80th of a second at this focal length was sort of what I thought was the limit. So I did two things. I gave it an increase in ISO by one stop, and I also gave it an increase in the exposure compensation, and this essentially leveled out, if that makes sense. I'm sorry, say that one more time. I'm not sure I followed.
The same photo with yes. ISO 800, mm-hmm. And the EV at 0. Mm-hmm. Will it be darker than this?
Yes, so.
Change those settings.
So again, it depends on the metering mode, but in this particular case, had I increased the ISO to 800 and left the exposure compensation alone, the camera would have re-metered the scene at ISO 800 and f2.8 and would have said, okay, well, now that he's bumped up the ISO one stop brighter, that means that I can now make the shutter speed one stop faster. So it would then use a shutter speed of 1/160th of a second, and you would get the exact same result. It would just be a little bit grainier because we're using a higher ISO, and there would be, there's not really much motion blur, but there would be less if any was present. Now, but what's more important than this, because this is getting sort of into the advanced usage of the exposure compensation, what's more important than worrying about these values themselves is the idea that you can override the meter and give it more, you can tell it that you want it to be brighter or darker. So giving it positive exposure compensation, increasing the exposure compensation by one stop, I'm telling the camera that it needs to be brighter. Had I gone the other way, had I gone to a negative exposure compensation, then what I'm telling the camera is that it had decided that the scene was too bright and it needs to be darker. So I gave, in this case, positive exposure compensation because the photo that the camera took is too dark and I wanted it to be brighter. And if I wanted to do the opposite, we might, let's say that I had overexposed an image slightly for whatever reason, then I might have to give it negative exposure compensation to overcome this brightness and make the scene darker as a whole. So in this case, this was the pinhole photo from a couple of years ago, and I did a very poor job calculating how long the shutter speed should be, and it overexposed the image by a considerable amount. And I later on had to go, and you can do this in software in addition to hardware, it's just usually riskier to do it in software. Later on, I was able to go down two stops of exposure compensation in software. Now, you shouldn't rely on software to do exposure compensation because the cameras definitely have hard limits of how many photons they can capture on the high end and the low end. It's better to get the exposure right the first time while you're at the scene, and then you can worry about modifying the color, et cetera, later. Do what I say, not as I do, that sort of thing. Don't rely on software to correct this. In this case, this was sort of a special case because this was a 10-minute exposure, and when I looked at it, I didn't want to have to recalculate and retake the photo in the middle of lecture, so I had to do it in software later. But it does go to show that you can provide negative or positive exposure compensation in software at a later point as well. Yes?
I understand that when it's overexposed, we lost information. Mm-hmm. So even when you use a software, it's not good. Mm-hmm. But what about the other way around, like the first one, that if we take it as normal, it's underexposed, but doesn't also have more information, rather than we overexposure compensation?
So the question is, I had mentioned before that overexposing an image is bad because then the camera is unable to capture all of the details within the scene, and you won't be able to recover that later at a later point if you try to darken the image in the computer. But is the opposite true, where if we had underexposed the image, does it retain that information still? The answer is yes and no. So while it's easier to make an image brighter later on, you're going to make it grainier, or you're going to give it more noise by increasing the exposure compensation in software at a later point, because these darker regions have much less information in the darker regions than it does in the brighter regions. So it's going to be less accurate compared to actually doing it properly the first time. So the shorter answer is that it is better in relative terms, it's better to underexpose than it is to overexpose, because you're more likely to be able to get an image with detail in it at a later point. But in absolute terms, it's better to get it right the first time. It's better not to underexpose or overexpose, because you can still lose details in the shadow. There are dark regions of the image that could just be too dark and the camera just cannot capture any detail. But it happens at a lower point than your overexposure does, if that makes sense. Yes.
Sorry. Putting aside that better to do it right the first time, mm-hmm. It's better to underexpose than overexpose.
If you're going to have
if you're going to take a bad shot.
If you're going to take a bad shot that you want to be able to recover later, I would argue that it's better to underexpose and lose detail than it is to overexpose and lose detail, because you're more likely to have detail in the shadow regions of the image than you are in overexposed regions, in portions of the image. So I happened to get lucky because I took this photo in RAW, and RAW has a lot more data within it than it does in JPEG. But had I taken this photo in JPEG, we can see regions that are definitely overexposed, like these people's faces, for example. There's no detail in these faces. And yes, I know there's motion blur, et cetera, but that's beyond the point. The point is that you can see no detail at all. That has been overexposed. Had this been taken in JPEG, there's no way I would have been able to recover that information. And usually, and again, it's sort of minor, but usually you'll have better luck brightening an image and getting detail back than you will darkening an image and trying to get detail back, if that makes sense. So neither one, just to be clear, neither one is ideal, but if you're going to mess up an image, try to underexpose it rather than overexpose it. Because once you have overexposed, once you've made pixels white from a camera, you will not recover data from it. That is, it is white, you will not get detail back from it. But there's stuff sort of hidden in the darker nether regions of an image that you might be able to recover. Yes?
So if I do have a picture that's over or underexposed, mm-hmm. the first thing that while I'm taking, I'm going to go for the next shot and I want to fix it. Mm-hmm. Would the first thing always be exposure compensation, or do I want to play with shutter speed and aperture first?
Yes, so this depends. So what is the first thing? If you take a photo, you look at it on your camera, and you realize that it is either underexposed or overexposed, what is your first step of action? What do you do to correct this? It depends on your metering mode. And if you're using the manual mode, then you would modify one of the three steps. Because in the manual mode, the camera is not deciding for you what the scene should be, what all of these three settings should be. So this exposure compensation doesn't make sense in the manual mode, right? Because the camera is not making an estimate, or it's not metering the scene for you, so you can't override a guess that it's making. So there's, in manual mode, there's no need really for an exposure compensation. So in that case, you would then modify one of the three settings. Now, if you are using a mode where the camera is deciding one or more values for you, and that's pretty much every mode except manual mode, then the first step would be to modify the exposure compensation. So if you're using aperture priority, the program mode, the green, very easy mode, pick up and take a photo sort of mode, the very first thing you would do is modify the exposure compensation depending on what's happening. If the photo is overexposed, you put in negative exposure compensation. You're telling the camera that it should be darker. If it's underexposed, you do the opposite. You tell the camera that it needs to be brighter, and you put in positive exposure compensation. So it might not make sense if it's underexposed that you need to put in plus or compensation, but just think of it in terms of where the end result should be. You're telling the camera that with positive exposure compensation, it needs to be brighter. So for every mode except the manual mode, if you have improperly, or if the camera has improperly metered the scene, you should go for the exposure compensation. That's why we're talking about it. It's very important for all modes except the manual mode. Yes?
What does exposure compensation look like on most cameras? Like if you're saying go for it, will I see something on my camera that says exposure compensation? Or?
Again, and I have to be really general, but it really depends on the camera. On Canon cameras, and I can show this to you just because I'm holding one, it's the big dial back here. When you are in a metering mode that allows you to modify the exposure compensation, so again, one of the modes that's not manual, you would turn this dial, and you would see like there's a little bar graph basically on the LCD, and sometimes you would see, here I'll try to draw what it looks like, and I apologize if it's difficult to see, but it might look something like this, and there's a little triangle that points sort of at the middle. Sorry, hopefully everybody can see this. I'll draw it over here, too. How about this? All right, so if I have a graph that looks like this, and there might be a little triangle right at the middle, this is 0, this is plus 1, this is minus 1. Typically, what a camera will do when you modify this, and it might be in an up arrow key, or it might be a dial that you actually turn, then if you want positive exposure compensation, you will see the arrow move this way. So this means it's one stop exposure, a positive exposure compensation. If you dial it in the other way, so you push the minus sign or you turn it counterclockwise, you would then see this. And again, of course, this really depends on the model. You should look up your specific manual, or you should look up in the manual how you can actually enter in exposure compensation. But at least on a Canon camera, you will see something like this. And typically, you have more than one stop difference. You'll have sometimes three stops and even beyond of exposure compensation in each direction that you want to be able to do. And you'll notice that there's these small tick marks as well. These are thirds of a stop. So just like ISO, shutter speed, and f-number can all be modified in thirds of a stop increments, so can you modify the exposure compensation in thirds of a stop. Make sense? Okay. Any questions so far? All right. So we've been talking about metering, and we've been talking sort of tangentially about the metering modes, but it is important to point out that there's a lot of really useless metering modes. Once you understand these three exposure values, the shutter speed, the ISO, the F number, once you understand what exposure compensation is and how you can use it, you can get rid of pretty much all of these easy, so-called easy metering modes that try to come up with all of these things for you. So you might have a dial that looks like this, and we can see a whole bunch of stuff on here. The green auto, this is completely auto mode. It does everything for you. It focuses for you. It does everything. Hopefully now you will no longer even want to use the fully automatic mode because it's sort of stupid. It tries to do everything for you, but it is not as smart as you are when you're trying to come up with these things. So hopefully now you'll be avoiding this. Now, if we just sort of go counterclockwise from there, you'll see that there's like a little flash icon with a no symbol through it. This just means that it's basically the same as the auto mode, but it's not going to, you're forcing it not to use a flash. The next one is sort of a woman with a hat. This is a portrait mode. Next one, you see a little mountain. That's a landscape mode. Next one seems to be a kid mode. Then you see a little person running. That's sports mode. Then usually this flower means a macro mode. Then you can see some other ones as well. This MASP. And these are the modes that you will probably end up using the most frequently now, from now on. Just because you understand what a lot of these things do, you can replicate all of these other modes that exist, all of these modes with the silly little icons, in these more advanced modes. The manual mode, the aperture priority, shutter priority, and the program modes, you can overcome and you can be able to replicate all of these different metering modes that exist on your camera. Did I see a question?
I don't understand what the macro mode is. Can you, just before we go on to the advanced modes, what's the little
flower?
So
usually the macro mode is sort of a special mode. Usually on most cameras, so most cameras that you will see this are like the compact cameras that have a special macro mode. And that just means that you are able to get very, very close to an object. And usually the macro mode will enable the lens to focus at a closer distance. There's a physical limit to how close you'll be able to focus a particular lens. But usually setting the macro mode, this is sort of a unique metering mode because not only does it change how the camera meters it, but it also usually enables another setting that is normally disabled in most cameras that allows you to get even closer and focus on things that are a bit closer to the lens. So typically, you would use this mode for flowers because you typically get kind of close when you're taking photos of flowers, or you would take it of like bugs or, you know, thing like very small details, that sort of thing. That's what the macro mode is. Well, it looks like I skipped over one. There's a guy with a rectangle around him, and there's a little star, meaning like night portrait mode. And frankly, all of these are really, really silly. And to prove this, we will talk about what each of these does after a short 5-minute break. So when we come back, we'll continue talking about metering modes. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So before the break, we were talking about metering, how the camera is able to determine what to use for all of the exposure values. And we started looking now at some of the various metering modes that a camera might have. So we talked about auto, fully auto mode, some of these other ones like portrait, landscape, sports, kid mode, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what do these modes actually mean? Well, they're nothing fancy. They're nothing special. All they really mean is that it still takes these three, it still calculates what each of these three exposure values should be. The difference is that it applies a bias to different ones. So what do I mean by that? Let's take a look at, for example, at the portrait one. So when we take a portrait, typically what you think of in terms of portrait photography is that you're going to take a picture of someone and then you want the background behind them to be blurred as much as possible. So with that in mind, how do we take a portrait photo? What do we modify? What do we do to get that effect? F number. So what about the F number? Right, so we want the F number to be as small as possible. We want the aperture to be as big as possible. So in terms of bias, it is going to bias the settings towards that. It will set, by default, the lowest F number that it possibly can, and then it will figure out the other two. So then the next most important one might perhaps be the shutter speed, because you're going to be hand-holding it and taking a picture of someone. So while the most important aspect in portrait mode is to actually take a photo with the background with the blurry background, which means a very low F number, it might also then try, if it has some leeway, it might also then try to have a relatively fast shutter speed and set the ISO to whatever happens to be appropriate. So what about landscape mode? Well, typically in landscape, you want to get as much of the scene in focus as possible. So you might then have the opposite. You might have a very high F number, relatively high F number. So by default, the camera might try to apply an F number of about F8 or so, something like that, F5.6, F8, and modify the other settings accordingly, really depending on the amount of available light. So let's see, what else do we have? Whether it's kid mode and sports mode, I would say that these two are actually kind of similar in that you want the shutter speed then to be very, very fast. You want to freeze the action because kids are quick, sports happens very, very quickly. So the bias then is towards a very, very fast shutter speed. And so what it might do is it might sacrifice some of the graininess or some of the noise. So what it might do is to obtain the fastest shutter speed possible, it might use the lowest F number it possibly can, and it might use the highest ISO that it needs to get away with, depending on the particular light that's available. So, in terms of bias, sports mode, kids mode, it's probably just going to try to make the shutter speed as fast as possible at the expense of these other things. Now, the macro mode, this is, I think, and I was talking about this a little bit in the break, I think this is sort of a special mode on many compact cameras. You typically won't see this mode on SLR cameras, but usually this is the only mode that does something more than just modify the exposure values. Most likely what this also does is enable the lens. Many lenses have the capability to change the focusing distance, the minimum focusing distance. And what I mean by that is that there might be a switch on some lenses, like there is on this one, that tells you how close or what range that this lens can focus on. So there's a little switch here that's, for example, will tell me that I can focus on either from 1.2 meters to infinity or 3 meters to infinity. And the difference, the reason that a lens might do this, the reason that a lens might limit itself in terms of how far or how close it can focus is speed. It's much faster for lenses to be able to focus from a sort of medium distance to an infinite distance than it is for a lens to focus at a very close distance to an infinite distance. So there might be this so-called focus limiter that exists in a compact camera, and usually a macro mode will remove that limiter so that you can focus as close to something as possible. But typically, what you will see on these same cameras is that there's a separate macro button altogether, and that does the same thing. It just removes this limiter and allows you to get close. So you still don't have to use this macro mode. You could still use one of the more advanced modes and just turn off this focus limiter or however it's called in your particular camera and allow you to get close to whatever it is that you are taking a photo of. Now, there's this one last scene of the person with the star, the sort of night portrait mode. This one is sort of up for interpretation. Most likely what it is going to do for a night portrait is maybe fire the flash and try to use also relatively long shutter speed so that it can capture some of the background light as well. It really depends on what they mean, but most likely I would say that's the case, where they try to combine flash with the long shutter speed to capture both. And we're going to talk about flash very, very shortly. Not at a future date, I promise. It's going to be very, very soon. Now, there's some other cameras as well that just go completely overboard with the modes. Like the one, for example, that's available for you to borrow from the Church Street Lab has like 30-something silly, stupid modes like self-portrait, party mode, candlelight, sunset, fireworks, beach, snow. Like, come on. It's really unnecessary. Once you start to learn these three different types, you don't need to have so many modes. And instead, you can rely on the more advanced modes that exist. And typically, as you get, and it's sort of counterintuitive, as you buy more expensive cameras, they usually come with fewer modes. And the reason is that they assume that you know what you're doing. When you pick up a camera that's, you know, $3,000 or $8,000, that you will know how to use one of these other modes that are available. And it's these modes that I think, if your camera has the capability to use them, you'll end up using more frequently than not. So let's start at the very top at C here and just go clockwise. So C is a custom mode. It's particular to this is a Canon 5D, by the way. It's the older 5D. They have these particular modes. A lot of Canon cameras will have custom modes where you can predefine some of the settings. Like, you can predefine having a very large having very large aperture, so having very low F number for portraits. You can predefine bulb mode or what have you. There's a whole variety of things that you might use custom modes for. It might change some of the settings. You might have mirror lockup enabled by default, so on and so forth. Custom mode really doesn't matter. But going on from there, you would have bulb mode, which we talked about already. It allows you to hold the shutter open for as long as you're holding down the shutter button itself. Then M is the manual mode. Of course, you're all familiar with this, where you manually adjust all three of the modes, all three of the variables by yourself, without help from the camera, though some cameras will try to help you out a little bit and tell you if it thinks it's a little too dark or a little too bright. Most of the time, though, or many cameras won't show you that information. Now, AV, that means aperture priority. And what that means is that the camera does meter, it does help you out a little bit, but you get to set some variables. So what you get to do is you get to pick the aperture, the F number that you want to use, and then the camera will decide the shutter speed. And the camera, depending on the camera might also help you decide the ISO. Now many cameras you can actually set the ISO separately, so you can tell the ISO to change automatically, or you can have the ISO be a fixed value. Frequently what happens, especially with cameras that are slightly older like this 5D, is that you have to set the ISO manually for all photos, and using aperture priority, you have to set the aperture, the F number, for all photos, and then it would help you pick the shutter speed, and it will show you the shutter speed that it thinks is appropriate. You can apply then exposure compensation to try to make that slower or faster, depending on whether the scene needs to be brighter or darker, respectively. Now, TV is time priority, or it's a shutter priority, which allows you to do the opposite. It picks the F number for you, and you get to pick the shutter speed that you want. And of course, the ISO you could then maybe set manually or automatically depending on the capabilities of your particular camera. P is a program mode where it's sort of an interesting mode. Again, you would set the ISO manually, and you have the option to adjust both the F number and the shutter speed at the same time. As you increase the aperture, so as you make the F number larger, then the shutter speed will become slower so that the shutter's open for longer time. I think it's of less use than the other two modes. And in particular, I think the mode that is used most often by people is the aperture priority. Now, both of these, the aperture and the shutter speed priority, sound like they are equally useful, but the fact of the matter is that shutter speed has a much wider range for the camera to pick from. It has a much wider range of stops for the camera to pick from about 1/8,000th of a second all the way up to 30 seconds than you do have a choice for aperture. So if you set it to shutter speed priority, for example, and you are way off base, let's say you have your camera set to like 30 seconds shutter speed or something like that, and it is just far too bright, there's nothing that the camera can really do, because the lens is physically limited in terms of how big and how small the aperture can be. So there's an actual limit. There's only so many stops of difference that you can change the lens's aperture, but you have a much wider range of shutter speed options available to you, and that's typically, I think, why you would see most people pick the aperture by default, and then let the camera pick the shutter speed, just because there's a much wider range of shutter speeds available. And also, it's actually pretty useful to be able to define the aperture that you want and the ISO that you want, and then have it tell you what it thinks the shutter speed should be. Then you can modify one or both of the settings as appropriate. So this, I think, you would then be able to, just using one of these modes, you could replicate all of these other modes that we saw on these other cameras. So this sports mode, for example, if you were using aperture priority, what might be your inclination? What should you try to do when you're trying to take sports photos in aperture priority? So you have no choice over the shutter speed, but you can trick the camera into getting a faster shutter speed by doing some things. So you want the F number to be as low as possible. So you will have the aperture be as big as possible on your particular lens. You might also increase the ISO slightly, maybe ISO 400, 800, or 1600, depending on the lighting conditions, so that the camera then decides a shutter speed that's relatively quick based on the metering that it has determined is appropriate for the scene. So what about portrait mode? What if we wanted to replicate this idea of portrait mode in the camera with aperture priority? Yeah, again, a small F number, the smallest one you possibly can, and ISO doesn't matter so much, but probably you would set the ISO just a little bit lower so you remove some of the noise or some of the graininess and let the camera pick the shutter speed there. So there really is nothing special about any of these modes that exist on a typical camera. You just have to decide what's appropriate for the scene and use one of these other modes to help you capture what you want. And these, I think, are sort of the ideal intermediate modes between the fully manual mode, which of course is a huge pain in the butt, takes forever for you to get proper, to get exposed properly, and the far too easy, because the camera's doing too much work for you, these easier modes that try to do this bias for you, that try to pick all of these things for you, which you may or may not actually want. You have much more control over the camera, but you also get the help from the camera at the same time by using one of these other modes. And that is why you will see these modes only on these more expensive cameras, just because they are the most useful. Once you understand these three variables and how they relate, how you can modify each of them, then it becomes very, very powerful for you to have the control over two of the three variables and let the camera pick the third for you. Now, we, of course, have been talking at great length about these three exposure values, the shutter speed, ISO, and the F number. But there is, of course, another way that we would be able to manipulate the light or the appearance of a photo as we capture it. And that would be to change the amount of available light that the scene actually has. And we can do that, of course, using a variety of techniques. Now, one of them, of course, being flash, we could, you know, try to limit the amount of light by using maybe sheets or reflectors to increase. Really depends. There's a whole bunch of things. But there's something interesting, I think, about flash, and that is that it has a lot of problems. And unless you know how to do it right, it can be more of a hindrance than a good advantage for you. And in fact, for many, many years, I absolutely hated flash. I only used available light. Whatever was available, I worked with it. Even if it was going to mean a grainy, horrible photo, I much preferred that over flash. And natural light has its advantages, and that is that it looks soft. It looks natural compared to especially a lot of the flashes that exist on cameras today. So we have here some natural light photos, for example, where these are now years old, of my brother on the left and my sister on the right. My sister is 5 years older now, and she hates that I still show this photo in this class. But it's fun, and I think it shows that, you know, natural light does provide a sort of dynamism to photos that flash just sort of removes. But this doesn't mean, and luckily I've now outgrown that idea that flash is inferior in some way, but it takes a little bit of getting used to. And frankly, flash is an extremely complicated subject. We could create an entirely new course on just flash photography. It is extremely, it's not necessarily difficult, But there are as many aspects of flash photography that are unique to that as there are to regular photography, and we really can only devote, you know, a little bit of time to flash. And, you know, I'll show you what I can, but there's a whole world of flash out there that you really should explore, because it's fantastic what you can do with flash units. You can do things with flash that you just cannot do with natural light. You just cannot accomplish some things with natural light that you can with flash photography. Now, there are some actual downsides to flash, and that is that it's distracting during sports, for example. Many times, if you are a sports photographer, your flash may not reach halfway across the field. It might be distracting to the players themselves. If you're trying to take photos in a natural environment, like a safari, for example, many people try to use flashes because it's nice to get, even if it's not actually illuminating the animal or the person that you're trying to take a photo of, it gives a little bit of a glimmer in the eye. If you know, there's a little bit of light that's reflected off of the eye, and it gives the impression of life to that animal or to that person that is added. But it can be distracting in those situations as well. But with all of that said, flash is a useful thing. The problem is that most flash looks like this. Every time you try to take a flash photo, you might have a flash that pops up out of your camera, like in this case of a Nikon D300 flash unit. Many Canon SLRs have, you know, pretty much the exact same thing where the flash pops up. Many compact digital cameras, they don't even have that much separation between the flash and the unit. Usually it'll just be in like the little corner of the camera itself. And this can have some significant downsides that we'll get to in just a little bit, but you can still use this idea of having a flash unit to your advantage in photos. Now, many flash units that are attached to a camera are pretty automatic. The camera will try to decide what is best in terms of the how much light to output from the flash and how fast the flash should output this light, all of these various other things. But to really learn flash photography, you should get, I think, a manual flash. Just like how you're learning exposure through using the manual mode in your camera, you can buy flashes, these older flashes from the 90s and even the 80s, that are fully manual, where you actually have to define how much light is going to be output by this, and you have to modify your own camera settings to be appropriate for the amount of light that's output. And it's an entirely different world. It's an entirely different way of thinking about exposure than we've been talking about up until now. But if you're interested in it, I certainly recommend picking one of those up before you start using some of these automatic flashes, because frankly, automatic flashes are really, really confusing, I think, to get right and to understand what they're doing, unless you have a good grounding in manual flashes. So, math alert. There's a little bit more math that we have to talk about, and that is this concept of light, of what happens to light as it propagates through space. And this is very, very important to flash photography. There's this concept called the inverse square law, where let's take a look at this sphere in the upper left-hand corner. You can see that at the very center, there's a letter S. Let's assume that we are looking at the solar system for this, and this letter S is the sun. And not this circle. I don't mean that this circle is the sun, but that letter S is the sun. Now, as the light is exiting the sun, there's a lot of light at the point immediately outside of the sun, right? There's just a whole bunch of light. You can imagine that as you get closer to the sun, the light becomes more intense. The heat becomes more intense. And this has to do with the inverse square law. As you get farther away from whatever is radiating the light, whether it's the sun, whether it be a flashlight, whether it be the lights that we have in this room, whether it be a flash unit itself, as you get farther away, the light dissipates more. So if we take a look at these four rays that exist that are coming out of the sun, they're sort of expanding out in this sort of square fashion, we can see what happens to these rays. So if we take a look at these rays. So let's say, again, if we look now at this sort of pyramid-looking diagram that's out here, we have some light that's coming from a point, whether it be the sun or a flash unit or what have you, and as it travels through space or through the air, it's expanding. It's going outwards. And you know this to be true because when we look at light, it goes everywhere, right? Unless we're talking about a laser itself, which is a very narrow-focused beam of light, light from a typical source expands everywhere in space. And so what happens is that as we get farther, so let's say that we've gone a distance r away from where this point source is, we have that much light available in this square here. But now if we go twice as far away, what happens is that that same amount of light now covers an area that's four times as much. So you can see that here. Now instead of having this one little square where those four photons are hitting, now there's four squares. And as we get three times as far, it's now nine times less light. So what this basically says, what the inverse square law basically says, is that as the distance r increases, the intensity of the light decreases by r squared. So let's take a look. So we have the intensity of the light, I, at the very top there, and it matches r right now. But as we get twice as far away, the intensity is now four times less. So the intensity divided by four. If we get three times as far away, so we have now a distance of three times r, our intensity is now the original intensity divided by nine. So however far our distance is, we square that, and we divide the intensity by that number, and that's how much we actually have. So what this basically means is that every time I square the distance, we have 1/4 the amount of light. We have two stops less light every time I double the distance. And again, this is, remember that one stop means we're having the light, so two stops is significant. Two stops is a very significant amount of light. And this happens to flash units. And this explains a lot of the bad things about flash, actually. So what is the typical, prototypical flash shot? Somebody takes a flash photo, and what do you typically see with it? Right, exactly. So whoever is standing right there, whoever is the subject, has very brightly overexposed face, and then everything behind them is very, very dark. And this is why, is because even if the background is only twice the distance away from you as your subject is, so let's say that I'm standing right here, my subject is 1 foot away, and the background is 2 feet away, the background is getting 1/4 the light that the subject is getting. So the camera, or the light that's coming from a flash unit, falls off very, very quickly. We call this light fall off. It just falls off very, very quickly, and it becomes dark very, very quickly. So there's really, because of what we've been talking about in terms of sensors, how much light that a sensor can actually capture, there's really a narrow band of distance that a camera can properly expose with a flash unit. Beyond that distance, it's just way too dark. And in front of that, it's just way too bright. And this is part of the problem that we have with flash units. And typically, what you will see for a flash unit is that its power will be rated with a guide number. And this guide number, it's one of these things. It looks like it's a really simple equation. Guide number equals distance times F number. But as we start to talk about it, it becomes a little bit more complex. And again, don't be worried, don't be confused. It looks simpler than it is at first glance. So a guide number, a flash unit is typically given a flash unit's power is typically given to you in terms of its guide number. Now, as with most numbers that are given to you by manufacturers, they can be fudged a little bit, they can be a little bit generous. It really is, you know, it's more marketing speak than anything, but it does have some basis for photography, and that is that the guide number will equal the distance that flash can properly expose with the given F number. Now you might say, well, why is F number the most important? Why is it not taking into account the shutter speed? Why is it not taking into account the ISO? Well, think about this for just a moment. A flash happens in an instant. It's very, very quick. It is faster than pretty much your fastest shutter speed that your camera is capable of. So shutter speed, in essence, is irrelevant. The flash dumps out however much light it's going to dump out in 1/1000th of a second, or in 32/1000th of a second, literally, and that's it. There's no more, there's no less light available. So your shutter speed really doesn't matter in terms of the amount of light that the flash is able to dump out. What will matter more is the F number. Because with the changing the aperture, you are then actually changing the amount of light that the flash is able to insert into your camera. that's being reflected off of the subject and entering into your camera. Again, the shutter speed really doesn't matter all that much because the flash is over before the shutter is able to really do anything. And again, you know, generalization, there's a big problem that we have to talk about still. But still, for the most part, the shutter speed just does not matter. Now, you might wonder why ISO is not listed here as well. Well, ISO, of course, is related to f-number in a very close way. We can modify the ISO. We can increase the ISO, and that would do something to the f-number, right? In essence, it just means that we can modify the ISO, and we can modify the f-number, and we would still be able to get the same distance out of this flash unit. So let's put some numbers behind this. Let's say that I have a flash unit that has a guide number of about 40 feet. Let's see. All right, I'll try to write this down. We have a flash unit with a guide number of 40 feet. What did I do with the stupid chalk? Found it. Okay. So we have a guide number of 40 feet. So this means that at a particular F number, I can have a particular distance away. So let's say that my subject is 10 feet away. Okay, that's pretty easy, right? My subject is 10 feet away. This flash can properly expose my subject at 10 feet away with a particular F number. And that F number would be F4. Right? 10 feet times 4 is 40. That's where this comes from. So all I am saying is that I can have an option here. I could do, if I didn't want 10 feet, let's say they were farther away, I would have to have a lower F number. Let's say, 20 feet away means that I would have to have an aperture of F2. This makes sense, right? The flash is only outputting a certain amount of light. And if my subject is closer to me, I have to limit the amount of light that my camera is capturing. So that means that if my subject is closer, I have to have a smaller aperture, which means a larger F number. If my subject is farther, I have to have a larger aperture or a smaller F number. And we can see that happening here with these two examples. So at 10 feet away, I can have F4, which is a very reasonable aperture for a typical lens. Many lenses are capable of F4. Fewer lenses are capable of F2. It's sort of a special lens that you would have to get in order to be capable of capturing F2. So there is an option. There's another option that I have that would be to modify the ISO. Let's say that I have a lens that is only capable of a maximum aperture of F4. Okay? So I do not have available to me an F2 lens. But my subject is 20 feet away. How am I going to make sure that the amount of light that's dumped out by the flash, when it bounces off the person 20 feet away, it comes back to my camera, that I'm able to capture that amount if I don't have F2? Increase the ISO. That's right. How much do I have to increase it? If this was at ISO 100, and typically these, when we're talking about guide numbers, we are talking about this same idea at ISO 100. So at 10 feet away times F4 at ISO 100. That's typically what I'm talking about in terms of guide number. But if I wanted 20 feet away, and again, my maximum aperture is F4, so that I have to have an F4, so I have to have an aperture of F4, how would my ISO change? So if I say F4 at 200, that sounds right, but it's not. Because F2 is not one stop away from F4. It's two stops away, so I have to multiply ISO by 2, so I have to get one stop brighter and then another stop brighter to compensate for this two-stop change in aperture. So now I have an ISO 400. Yes?
42 is not two-stop, right?
It is. We have F1, F1.4, F2, F2.8, then F4. That's one stop and then two stops away. So F4 is two stops darker than F2 because there's F2.8 right here.
But I thought that one between 1.4 and 2 is not one stop.
between 1.4 and f2, this is one stop. This list is one stop away. From f1 to f1.4, that's one stop. 1.4 to 2 is one stop. 2 to 2.8 is one stop. And 2.8 to 4 is one stop.
Yeah, I thought it is the square 2, which is 1.4. 1.4 makes it one stop.
No, every 1.4 makes it two stops. So I'd have to refer you back to the aperture and F number document to prove why this is true. But this is certainly the case where F2 to F4 is not one stop away like it sounds. Remember, we have the funky numbers in terms of F numbers. It's actually two stops away. So if I want to double my distance, and again, this goes back to the inverse square law. If I want to double my distance, I have to make my sensor four times as sensitive. This is exactly what we were talking about before, where I have doubled my distance, and that means that I have 1/4 the intensity of light. So I have to make my ISO go up by two stops. Yes?
The camera we borrowed from the lab had a 3.2 f-stop. It seems like there's cameras that have different stops.
Yes, there's different. So just like we can talk about shutter speeds that are 1/3 of a stop away, and we can talk about ISO that are 1/3 of a stop away, There are F numbers between these. So I think 1/3 of a stop away from 2.8 is, I think, 3.2 or something. And then 1/3 of a stop away from that is 3.5. So you can approximate, but one stop away from 3.2 would probably be like 4.5 or something like that. One full stop away. So there are third stops between each of these. It's just that there's no easy way of remembering those, and so I tend to just sort of ignore them, frankly. Well, I mean, I don't ignore them, but I just sort of, I almost round, if that makes sense, and I just will use that as a rough guide to determine about how many stops away it is. But yeah, if you see 3.2, don't be shocked or surprised. Just realize that that's between 2.8 and 4, and it's probably a third of a stop away from one of those. So hopefully now this guide number makes a little bit more sense. Hopefully now you're seeing this complexity that I'm talking about, where it's not the case where you can just, well, you can multiply this very easily, but when you throw ISO into the mix in order to compensate for this change in distance or to compensate for this change in F number, it does become a little bit hairy, and that's just because the F number, like we've talked about before, you can't nicely double it or halve it to get a stop difference. So this, I think, helps show not only this idea of the inverse square law, where if we want to double the distance to keep the same F number, we have to actually increase the ISO by two stops, but it also shows that there is, that this guide number, while this is certainly true, you have to take a lot of care to make sure that you consider the ISO as well. So let's say that I am still working with this same thing. Now, let's say that I had another lens entirely that was 2.8 instead of f4 at ISO 100. So just ISO 100 is just sort of the default for most of these guide numbers. What does that mean I can have in terms of the distance? So I have a lens that's now one stop brighter. How much extra distance does that give me for a flash that has the same guide number of 40 feet? So something times 2.8 equals 40 feet. What is that something? So it's, wait, did I hear 500? So it's, I know it's a little bit more complicated, the math, but it's about 14 feet. So 14 times 2.8 is about 40 feet. It's close enough that we can consider this to be correct. Okay? So hopefully now this makes sense as well. We've gone one stop brighter in terms of our lens. So we now have a lens that's one stop brighter, but we don't get double the distance out of it, right? Because of the inverse square law, we only get a little bit more feet out of this particular case. But this shows us something else. This shows us the distance that this flash can properly expose if we continue to use F4 at an ISO one stop difference. So this means that at 14 feet, if I use an F number of F4, I can use an ISO of 200 to get a properly exposed photograph. So how I can figure out what one-stop difference is to just calculate one-stop difference in the F number and use that. So one stop brighter than F4 is 2.8. I figured out the distance that this flash should be able to illuminate properly at that F number. Then I can say, okay, well, this is the same thing. Using a 2.8 lens at ISO 100 is the same thing as using an F4 lens at ISO 100, or rather ISO 200, right? Because it's the same number of stops difference. We're just compensating for the brightness with a different exposure value. Okay? Okay, good. I see some nods and not too many confused faces, so that is promising. But this shows you how, if you wanted to calculate with a particular guide number, if you wanted to calculate the new distance, you can pretend that you have a lens that's one stop brighter. If you wanted to, let's say, bump up the ISO by one stop, you want to figure out how to do it, you can pretend you have a lens that's one stop brighter, perform the calculation, and say, okay, now I can see that this will illuminate 14 feet away, and then you can readjust. So go back to F4 at ISO 200 rather than 2.8 at ISO 100. Yes? We are using this equation, that we are given a guide number by a flash. So we know that a particular flash has a specific guide number. And I'm just using 40 feet as sort of a typical flash guide number. And we're using that. We know that the guide number, it approximately equates to the maximum power that the flash can provide. It's not quite that, but it's close enough that we can say, okay, that's the maximum distance that this flash can illuminate. So, or, well, it's not quite that, but this is the maximum guide number. This is the maximum power that the flash can provide to us, and I can figure out how to properly expose a photograph then with a specific distance and a specific F number. So I would say if I am limited to a specific F number, I could figure out how far away my subject can be with this specific flash to properly illuminate them. So that was the very first thing that we were talking about, where if I have a lens that's F4, for example, and I want to find out just how far away my subject can be to properly illuminate them, then the guide number of 40 and an F number of 4 means that they can only be 10 feet away for them to be properly illuminated.
So that's not, the X is not a times, that is distance X.
No, this is a times. This is meant to be distance times F number. Right. So again, 40, so if we had a guide number of 40 and the subject was 10 feet away, then that means that 10 times something equals 40, so then the F number would be 4, F4. Let's see, if you wanted to take a photo at 40 feet, then, so the guide number would be 40, the distance would be 40, that means your F number must be 1.
The lowest value possible.
Well, there exist lenses that are F.95, but frankly, you will have to sell your house to buy one of these. And even these lenses that are F1, they are so rare and so expensive that most likely you're not going to obtain one. But it is theoretically possible to have a flash operate at its maximum guide number by using a lens that has a maximum aperture of F1. But it's just that I don't think any of us will purchase or even see one of these for many, many years. They're just very rare, these types of lenses. But yes, theoretically, it's definitely possible. Now, if we double the guide number, just to give you an idea, that means, because of this inverse square law, that we are essentially increasing the power by 4 times. So just imagine this, that we have a guide number of 80 feet. That means that at 10 feet, we could have an F number of F8, which is 2 stops away, which is 4 times the power. Just to show that doubling the guide number actually equates to 4 times the intensity out of this particular flash unit. So increasing the guide number is actually kind of a significant thing. Increasing it by even a small amount does actually mean that there's a significant increase in power. Yes?
If, for example, it should be 8, but if
If you have a flash with a guide number of 80 and you are doing it and you take a photo with the subject at 10 feet away with an aperture of f4, then you will likely overexpose. The subject will be two stops overexposed, so they will appear completely white. But you can adjust for that by increasing your F number. Now again, we talked about how shutter speed is irrelevant, right? Because it really doesn't matter. These flashes output their full amount of power in an instant. And usually the flash will output its full power in 1/1000th to 1/8000th of a second. But like with everything in photography, it's not quite that simple. Usually you are burdened to set your shutter speed to something called the X sync speed. There is a sync speed that is associated with most, if not all, SLR cameras. And the reason for that deals with the shutter speed, with the shutter itself. Now, we saw the videos of the shutter, and don't be surprised, we saw the shutter videos where they went along the other axis, where they went along the vertical axis of the sensor. There do exist some shutters that can go left to right as well, like you see here. But basically, you might recall that there were two shutters. There was the first shutter that opens, then there's the second shutter that closes, and then the whole thing is reset when the mirror comes back down. Now, let's assume that we have a shutter that opens for a specific amount of time, and there exists a speed at which the camera will be able to open one shutter completely, hold it open for however minuscule of a time, and then close the other one immediately following it. And that compares to the videos in that that's not what we saw. What we saw was that one shutter was opening and then the other was trailing it immediately. So imagine what would happen if I had that scenario where I had just a little sliver of the sensor exposed at a particular moment in time and I flashed a flash unit for a very brief amount of time, just while that shutter has that little sliver exposed. What will happen is that only that small portion of the image will actually be exposed and everything else will be dark. So when we are taking a flash photo, the camera, especially SLR cameras, this is one of the things that compact cameras actually do better than digital SLRs, because compact cameras do not have these physical shutters, they don't have this limitation. But for cameras that have these physical shutters, there's the limitation that the shutter speed can be no faster than that point in time, that difference when the camera is able to open one shutter completely and have the entire film or have the entire sensor exposed to the scene before it starts closing the other one. If it operates in this other mode, in this faster mode, where it can actually open and close the entire shutter at a faster speed, you will only expose a portion of the image, not the entire thing. So there exists a maximum shutter speed with SLRs that you will be able to use a flash properly. And this is called the X sync speed. And typically, it's about 1/200th or 1/250th of a second. Any faster than that, and the camera starts going into this mode, where there is no point where the entire sensor is exposed. There is always a point in time where a portion of the sensor is covered by one or both of the shutters. So any faster than 1/200th or 1/250th of a second, you will get dark bands on your image because the flash will occur and you will get a little bit of the sensor exposed that will be properly exposed to the scene, but the remainder will not. It will be covered in black. So you will not see anything. So this X sync speed is something that applies to SLRs. Compact cameras typically use an electronic shutter so that it only captures photons based on a timer. And because it has the electronic sensor and it's able to do this, its X sync speed of most compact cameras can actually be the maximum speed of the maximum shutter speed anyway. So that's sort of an advantage to compact cameras. And as a result, X sync speed you typically don't hear in context of compact cameras really matters mostly to SLRs. Now, with most flash units, you can actually define the speed of the flash because usually they will fire from about 1/1000th of a second and dump out their full amount of power. You can actually decrease the amount of time that it will expose that power, so you can go down to about 1/32000th of a second. But that also means that it's going to produce that much less light. That makes sense. So 1/1000th to 1/32000th is the difference of, let's see, 1 to 2000th, that's one stop, to 4 to 8 to 16 to 32, so that's five stops difference of flash output. So it's not that the flash can produce brighter flashes or less bright flashes, it's that to supply less light, it will just fire the flash more quickly. Right? So if the flash is fired for 1/2000th of a second rather than 1/1000th, it's just letting out half as much light. Now, this doesn't really apply to the X-sync speed, but what this does allow us to do is we can actually then, if we set the flash at its lowest power setting, that means the flash is going to operate as quickly as possible, and we can take photos of events that occur much more quickly than our shutter speeds would ever be able to achieve. 1/32000th of a second is much faster than the maximum of many shutter speeds, 1/8000th of a second or 1/4000th of a second. So, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, but if we want to take a flash, or if we want to take a picture of an event that happens so quickly that we need to use flash at its maximum power, we should actually use a long shutter speed. We use a long shutter speed in a dark room. So bear with me for a minute, and I know this sounds counterintuitive, but just pretend that we have a completely dark room. Okay, there's no light in this room whatsoever. But we have a flash unit in this room. By default, the flash doesn't output any light, right? But we set the flash at its fastest power setting, or in other words, its lowest power setting, so that it dumps out the light in as quick of a flash burst as it possibly can, maybe 1/32000th or maybe even faster, depending on the flash unit that we have. Now, let's say that we have our shutter open for a certain amount of time, and when some interesting event happens, we fire the flash for that brief moment in time. And remember that typically when we take a photo, we cannot have the shutter open for a faster speed than the X-sync speed. 1/250th of a second is a lot slower than 1/32000th of a second. So we will eliminate the shutter altogether. If we just leave the shutter open and it's collecting light, but there's no light because it's a completely dark room, the only light it captures is that from this very, very fast flash. So what, in essence, what we're doing is we are capturing some very fast event that is happening in a dark room, even though we're holding our shutter open. And if we have our shutter open before the flash happens and during the flash and then after the flash, it doesn't matter, because all that will be illuminated is that brief moment in time when the flash actually fired. So for that 1/32000th of a second, we've output all of the light that the flash is going to give us, but because we're holding the shutter open in a dark room, we've only captured that light from the flash itself, and we can use this to try to figure out, or we can use this to obtain a photo of something that happens very, very quickly. And there's actually, this was actually pioneered by a guy named Dr. Edgerton, and actually he was involved with MIT, and there's a whole Dr. Edgerton Center at MIT, and they have a whole bunch of neat like strobe effects and a whole bunch of neat classes actually that are involved with this. And how you can actually capture something like this is, again, you have the dark room, you have the flash set, but how do you actually cause the flash to fire? Well, you can actually create a circuit, and they're relatively simple circuits that react to maybe some sounds, or that react to something that happens in the room. Usually it is by sound, so that when some loud event happens, like when the bullet hits this apple, for example, this circuit hears that because it has a microphone, and it fires the flash at that instant. And that is how you're able to trigger a flash at this exact moment in time. And of course, you might have to dial in maybe a little bit more or a little bit less of a delay from when it's going to fire the flash from when it actually hears the sound. It might take a lot of trial and error to get a photo like this, but it is possible to do. Yeah?
Wouldn't the sound of the bullet firing from the gun be louder than the sound of the bullet hitting an apple?
Well, then you could create a circuit that ignores the first sound. There's a whole bunch of different things that you can do, but there do exist circuits that this is possible, where you can have it ignore, or you could have it timed. Rather than ignoring the first sound, you could have it timed after it hears the bullet fired, so that maybe half a second, 0.56 seconds after it actually occurs, it actually causes the flash to fire, it will cause some, you'll need some adjustment to try to determine when after the sound occurs that you should actually take the proper photo. Yep.
It doesn't have to be completely dark, right? Just to make that.
It should be nearly dark, because if you're going to hold the shutter open for a longer period of time, you don't want extraneous light sort of ruining your photo. So I would say that when you're actually going to take the photo, you can have the lights on, but then when you're actually going to take it, turn off the lights and hope that you didn't point the gun somewhere you weren't supposed to. Okay. Now, let's see. This is actually a similar idea that you would use to take photos of lightning. So, yes, lightning happens very, very quickly. You might wonder, how can people take photos of lightning? They don't use fast shutter speeds. They use slow shutter speeds, and they wait for the lightning to fire. And because the lightning is so bright, it will illuminate in this longer shutter speed. And so you're using this property of this very bright light that's happening in a split second and using that to your advantage with these very fast, or with these very slow shutter speeds.
Yes. In that case, you don't have a circuit board to, you kind of miss it, right, a lot.
If you're taking photos of lightning, then yeah, you can miss it a lot. Frankly, it's going to be a little bit of luck. You point it at an area with storm clouds where you see a lot of lightning, you set a long shutter speed, and you just kind of cross your fingers and hope that you will capture some lightning. And yes, it does take some trial and error. There's not really a good way, because lightning is unpredictable. You can't predict where it's going to strike. Yep?
Use a lightning rod.
Use a lightning rod, yeah. That. Yes, that requires more setup if you're going to go quite a distance and set up lightning rod, then come back and continue taking photos back from your original position. Now, this is, I think, a lot of the benefits to flash photography, but there are some downsides as well, like this horrible, horrible photo. It's another one of those photos that I just cringe every time I have to show it, but this is a bad photo. But before we can actually talk about this, we have to take a break for about a week. So next week, we will continue talking about some of the horrors of flash, and we will talk, I think next week we start talking about optics. So thank you all for coming. We will see you next week.